One of the most distressing things nowadays, and when I say nowadays, I mean for years and years and years now, is the existence in the world of what is called terrorism. Just before Sechin, there was a bombing in Belgium, and I believe 13 people were blown to bits, and almost 300 people were injured, some of them severely. Just going about their daily life. Just being in the airport, being in a subway, just suddenly their worlds are turned upside down, changed forever. Not just for them, but for everyone who loves them, knows them, interacts with them. And for all of us as human beings throughout the world, we all know that this is happening, and it colors our world. Now, what is even more distressing is that these acts of terrorism are done in the name of religion and done for the service of something that these terrorists refer to as God, Allah, whatever name you want to give this, one master of the universe. There's a flaw in the thinking, however, because if this God is the God of all beings, and every religion believes that their God is the one God, the superior God, the supreme God, why would anyone who believes in this God kill one of God's creatures, a being that God created? Are you saying God made a mistake? There's a profound disconnect here. How did this happen? I remember years ago, during another spasm of terrorism in the world, reading an article in the New York Times, and I believe that the article's title, and I think Richard Clark actually pointed this out to some of us, was entitled, the headline was, "The Tribal Roots of Ethnic Hatred." And this article went in depth into the evolutionary roots of the humanoid. How in earlier but closely related species, for example, a chimpanzee, which is incidentally the most genetically closely related species on Earth to a Homo sapien. We share about 98% of our genetics. It's really remarkable that only a 2% difference creates all the difference that we see between chimpanzees and humans. 2%. Now, this article cited some research into chimpanzee life, and one of the striking facts about chimpanzees that seems to run counter to their great love of one another and picking insects off each other and their social networks and their intelligence, their ability to create tools and all the rest of it, is that they can become extremely violent. If a non-tribal, particularly male, enters the realm of another tribe, and somehow they know this, they know that it's from a different tribe, I'm not sure if they do it through smell or sight or some other sense, the chimpanzees will set upon this chimpanzee, and they won't simply drive it away. They won't punish it. They won't just kill it. They'll actually tear it limb for limb. They will tear it apart in the most violent way. Now remember, we share about 98% of our genes with chimpanzees. So, in our species, long, long ago, tribalism, which we inherited from earlier forms of life, began to gel into a set of affiliations, characteristics, geography, skin color, belief systems, and these were the early forms of what we now call religions. Religions. Now, these religions, particularly the ones we know best, emanated from some deep insight. If you look at the what are called the three major religions in the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and there are others too, I think they're just as major. You could add in there Hinduism, Buddhism, and there are many others in addition to that. They all seem founded on a particular critical insight. As something that connects everyone. Something that can't easily be put into words. Something that emanates from everything. In the Old Testament, you can recall that Moses went to Mount Sinai, and when he received the Ten Commandments from God, he asked God, "What is your name?" And God said to him, "Yahweh," which is translated into, "I am that I am. I am that I am." There's a old Hebrew prayer. It's actually the highest prayer in Judaism. I remember repeating it as a child many, many, many times. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. And it goes like this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. This is the foundation of these religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, came from and holds the Old Testament in high regard. And yet, somehow, tribalism infected even these profound insights. And this tribal root of ethnic hatred began to use religion as a weapon, as a tool of hatred, killing. All of us have done this. The flavor of the month right now might be the Muslim adherents, people who call themselves Muslims, but Jews did it, Christians do it, Hindus do it, Buddhists do it. What is the fault here? What is the problem here? As we've been saying the past couple of days, meanings are the barrier. Meanings. Beliefs. Mental concoctions that are then held as independent from and apart from the world, supervening all the other aspects of our life and becoming all important. And then around these meanings, we create a set of rituals, costumes, practices, places of worship. We identify with those who believe in the same meanings and beliefs and rituals and practices and places of worship, and we defend the borders of this group. And even within religions, there are battles between sects. Most obvious one nowadays is between the Sunnis and the Shia. They all believe in the same God and the same purported religion, yet kill one another. And religion is still held very deeply by human beings as the possibility of freedom from suffering. But unfortunately, the way that it's evolved, religion is, for most people, Buddhists included, a way of searching for the North Star but looking south. As long as you're looking south, walking south, proceeding south, towards beliefs, rituals, notions, ideas, faiths, you will never see the North Star. So in Zen, some people call this an anti-religion. Perhaps it's as practiced here. If we wanted to define it as Zazen, it is a method of finding the North Star that involves no beliefs. As I said before, meaning is the barrier. We have to get this from the very beginning. You can't figure your way into it. You can't calculate. You can't make a picture in your mind. You can't find it in words. We have to make a critical turn. This turn is from looking south towards all the creations of the conceptual making mind to north, which is to the very essence of the mind. We have to go and make a turn from the creations of the concept making facility of the mind to the very essence of the mind is the only way we will find this North Star. So I've talked during this session repeatedly about a very direct way, very fast way of making this turn. But would all the people on earth and all the religions and all the folks that are creating mayhem just simply do this one thing, things would change very rapidly. What we need to do is, first of all, when thoughts arise, notice that they are there. That is the very first step, to notice that we are thinking. Notice it. And then we begin to make our turn from south to north. We let go of, temporarily perhaps, with great gentleness and humor perhaps, the meaning of this thinking. We just set it aside. We just put it down. It's so boring. But we are very curious with the sensation of thinking. Because as I said before, meaning, although it may be the barrier, sensation is the doorway. Now, let's take up a koan. This is from the Hekigan Roku. We talked about this book yesterday. And this is a koan late in the Hekigan Roku. It's koan number 78. And it deals with this issue of sensation being a doorway. So I'll read the koan. I'm reading a translation from this wonderful book by Katsuki Sekida. It's called Two Zen Classics, and it has the entire Mumonkan and the entire Hekigan Roku. The Hekigan Roku is truncated, as I said, because the full text is the size of War and Peace. So I'll read this case 78, and its title is Bodhisattvas in the Bath. The main subject goes like this. In ancient times, there were 16 bodhisattvas. At the monks' bath time, following the rule, they had baths. They suddenly experienced realization through the touch of the water. You reverend Zen students, do you understand their words? Quote, we experience the subtle and clear touch, have attained Buddhahood, and still retain it. End of quote. You will be able to attain this condition after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. That's the case. Secho wrote a verse to this case. Once again, Secho was the compiler of the koan. Most of these koan have a subject and a verse. Some of them don't have the verse. Maybe it was lost when the book was destroyed. And then Engo wrote the commentaries and the introductions. I'll go on and read from Sekida about Engo's commentary, but let's read Secho's verse on this. The enlightened man, or woman, is master of one single thing. Stretches at ease on his bed. If in a dream the ancients said they were enlightened, let them emerge from the scented water and I would spit at them. This is the verse. So let's take a look at this. So in ancient times, from the very beginning, this truth, this reality, has always been so. Bankei was a famous Zen master. Several hundred years ago, would always refer to this truth as the unborn Buddha mind. Unborn. Had no beginning. There was no time before which it was. So it says here, in ancient times, there were 16 bodhisattvas. Well, it could just be one, but there were 16. There were actually, if you read, and I'll read the commentary, in the Sarangama Sutra, which is the text, the root of where this koan comes from, there were 25 bodhisattvas, but 16 of them were the ones that gained enlightenment through touch. They described it as subtle and clear touch, subtle and clear. And they attained Buddhahood. How strange, just by going into a bath? And they still retain it. It can't be lost. Once it's seen, you may forget it, but it is always in operation. And then it says, you will be able to attain this condition after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. This is exactly what our practice is. Piercing, piercing. Piercing. Piercing what? Piercing is the very act of letting go of meaning. The moment meaning is let go, and the sensation of thinking is observed, you have begun piercing. Now I want to read the notes on this. They're really very wonderful and emphasize again how important sensation is. Getting away from all the meanings that led to the mayhem we see in the world today. So, Sekida here is commenting on the word 16 bodhisattvas. This is also in the actual tome of the Hekigan Roku. Engo comments on this too. 16 bodhisattvas. In the Surangama Sutra, there is an episode in which 25 bodhisattvas relate their experiences of attaining realization. First, Kyochinyo and four others, these were the first five disciples of the Buddha, stand up and describe their paths to realization. Kyochinyo says, "As for my realization, seeing a sight was the primary cause of it." Second, Kyogon Doji, student of Zen, says, "Smelling a scent was the cause of my realization." Third, Yakuo and Yakujo, sight tasting is the cause of their realization. Fourth, Badabara and 15 other bodhisattvas of the present case rise and make obeisance to the Buddha. And Badabara says, "We formerly heard the preaching of Ayon O." This was the first primordial Buddha, so this is an apocryphal story. Said, "We formerly heard, maybe in past lifetimes, the preaching of Ayon O, the first Buddha, and became monks. At the monk's bath time, following the rule, we entered the bathroom. We suddenly experienced realization through the touch of the water. We did not wash off dirt, did not wash the body. We achieved peace of mind and obtained the state of no possession. The aforementioned Buddha named me Badabara, saying, 'You have experienced subtle and clear touching and attained Buddhahood and retain it.' The answer to your question, therefore, is that touching was the primary cause of our realization." Other bodhisattvas, in turn, tell of their experiences, and finally, Bodhisattva Kanan Avalokiteshvara cites the importance in his case of listening to sound. Intently listening to sounds. It will be seen that the primary cause, and this is now Sekida speaking, it will be seen that the primary causes of realization named here are all sensations, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and hearing. Sensing is the action of what he calls the first nen, nyen, first nen, which performs pure cognition. I'll go into that in a little while. In fact, other bodhisattvas cite examples of thinking. Thinking of emptiness of the ego, of the body, of mental processes, and so on, as the cause of their realization. Some of their examples sound like conceptual manipulation. I admit that even conceptual manipulation may lead to pure cognition. But sensation always takes the lead, even in thinking. There is nothing wrong with thinking. If you want to work with thinking as a sensation, and the thought that you're thinking that's troubling you seems to slip away from you, then just bring up the thought, there is nothing wrong with thinking, and observe its sensation. This is the critical turning around. From looking south, running south, chasing south, following all the other people who are going south, to turning north and walking alone. Now, a little bit about this issue of nen. So, through this practice of zazen, we look so intently and in such pointed detail, painstakingly, we begin to notice things that would happen below our awareness when we're caught up in our thoughts and actions and plans, etc., etc., one thing we notice is that there is a moment of sensation that has nothing between you and it. This is called the first nen. A nen means thought moment. It's a Japanese term for thought moment. There are actually a series of very rapid-fire thought moments, one leading to the next, leading to the next, leading to the next, which then result in the conceptual world, the world with names attached to it, the world where everything has a meaning, everything has a purpose, and then I have a relationship to it, it fits into a certain scheme, and then I like it or I don't like it or I ignore it. But the first nen is this initial contact, pure cognition, nothing intervening. The second nen is the very beginning of separating from this sensation. First nen is really sensation, pure sensation. Second nen is the recognition that you are having a sensation. And the third nen is then recognizing the sensations fitting a category. See how this happens so rapidly. But in our zazen, we're able to slow it way down and stop it and see it directly, this first nen. Now, just carrying on with this importance of sensation being the doorway, I want to read you something from the 10 ox herding pictures, these famous 10 ox herding pictures, which were created to depict various stages of Zen training and enlightenment. So I'll read you now the third ox herding picture, which is one depicting what is called Kensho, which is the first clear perception, breaking through, piercing and breaking through. So the title of this is First Glimpse of the Ox. If he will but listen intently to everyday sounds, he will come to realization at that instant, see the very source. The six senses are no different from this true source. I'll say that one more time. The six senses, and that includes seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. The six senses are no different from this true source. In everyday activity, the source is manifestly present. It is not hidden. It is shining from each of these things. Shining. The source is manifestly present. It is analogous to the salt in water. It isn't always... It doesn't stand apart, but you can instantly taste it. Or the binder in paint, that which makes paint stick to the wall. It doesn't separate from the color, and the salt isn't separate from the water. When the inner vision is properly focused, one comes to realize that that which is seen is identical with the true source. That which is thought is identical with the true source. That which is heard is identical with the true source. And then there's a poem. A nightingale warbles on twig. The sun shines on undulating willows. There stands the ox. Where could it hide? That splendid head, those stately horns. What artist could portray them? What thought could picture it, put it into a category, and go off and running second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, tenth nen? What artist could portray them? I'm going to go even a little deeper into these ox herding pictures to skip over the fourth and go to the fifth ox herding picture, which is now into the cultivating of this. Remember, it's seven times piercing, eight times breaking through. The whole process of this practice is piercing, 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 breaking through, breaking through, breaking through, continually refreshing it, never letting it turn into an idea and turn south again. And then that idea becomes solidified. It turns into a doctrine. The doctrine turns into religion. The religion gains adherents, and the adherents kill one another. We can never let this happen. We must refresh our practice all the time. So this is all about taming the ox. Now the ox is this source. It's also your true mind. Not the contents of your mind, but your mind. So this one is called taming the ox. With the rising of one thought, another and another are born. Enlightenment brings the realization that such thoughts are not unreal, since even they arise from our true nature. And that says it all right there. These thoughts are not unreal. In other words, they are not outside of reality. They are not outside of Buddha nature. They are not outside of source. They are not outside of nowness. They arise from our true nature. Even thoughts, even troubling thoughts, even disturbing thoughts, even hateful thoughts, even greedy thoughts. Because in essence, what is a thought? If you look directly at it, you engage the first nen. A thought is fundamentally a sensation. The sensation of thinking. It is only because delusion still remains, it's only because we are still involved in the meaning of the thought, which is delusory, which is something we add, that they are imagined to be unreal. In other words, thoughts are imagined to be blocking us, inhibiting us. So we have to then corral them, punish them. We have to make good thoughts and bad thoughts. So then we have what's called belief systems, where we are taught to, told to, commanded to think a certain kind of set of thoughts and despise another set of thoughts. And anyone holding to those other set of thoughts is actually an infidel and should be killed. And all the rest of it. This state of delusion does not originate in the objective world, the solid world, but in our own minds with a small m. Our own minds we created. Mumon had a beautiful commentary on one of the koan in the Mumon Khan where he described the state of the human being as creating a mask and then holding it up to scare oneself with the mask. It's exactly what we're talking about here. So then there's a poem here for this ox-herding picture. He must hold the nose rope tight and not allow the ox to roam back into ideas, concepts, particularly the ideas of holy and not holy, spiritual and not spiritual, enlightened and not enlightened, a Zen Buddhist and not a Zen Buddhist. I've got it, that one doesn't have it. Remember two monks raising the blinds. And Hogan, they raised them alike. Hogan pointed to them and said to the assembly, one has it and the other has not. There's a saying in English, in British speech, he threw the cat amongst the pigeons. Threw a cat in amongst the pigeons, just to stir things up, just to hook people. One has it and the other has not. So these are the muddy haunts. Don't allow the ox to roam, lest off to muddy haunts it should stray. And follow one thought with another, with another, with another, and you're going down the primrose path heading south. Properly tended, it becomes clean and gentle. Untethered, it willingly follows its master. This is important too. this aspect of our Zen practice of tending this awareness of thought being sensation, then seeing something about sensation, seeing that sensation, how could I put it, has nowness. Nowness. As Dogen said, being is time and time is being. Nowness, time, not relative time, not the time that is derivative of memory and comparison. That's what you would call relative time. When you drop off the meaning of a thought and observe its sensation, immediately in the observation, notice that this thought has nowness. It's not what this thought is, its meaning. It's that it is. That it is. Peer into that. Look deeply into that. Time is being, as Dogen said. Being is knowing. And knowing is intimate. Say that again. Time is being. This now time, absolute time. Original time. Uncreated, unborn, undying. Time is being. Being is knowing. Knowing is intimate. We're in there today.